Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Saints Raiders in Las Vegas. Man, that was weird. Really, really weird. And not just because the Raiders were opening up a stadium in Las Vegas without any fans. Like, don't get me wrong. That's a really nice looking edifice. A really nice looking stadium. A really nice looking stadium, but I would be lying if I said I didn't miss the infield. I miss third base. I miss deep short. I miss the pitcher's mound. I always loved QB1, towing the rubber, and running backs sliding hard into second base to break up that double play. I mean, again, an amazing looking stadium. The torch is cool. The grass looks great. But you can't tell me that that field wouldn't look better with the second base bag right around the 40-yard line. It would, and you know it, and so do the players and the networks who show up to televise those games. But that wasn't the only weird thing about last night. How about that location of that TV cart that damn near killed Raider Jonathan Abram?
Here's Kamara trying to get to the corner, won't get there. Excellent speed by Damon Arnett.
Yeah, you look at it.
Abram is down, I believe.
And he hit the cart over there. He was running full speed
injury
after
him out.
Wow, this is scary. Jonathan Abram suffered an injury in the opening Monday night game a year ago back in Oakland and was lost for the entire season. Suffered a torn labrum and rotator cuff in his NFL debut. Played last week and here early in just his third NFL game.
Yeah, like, you might want to do something about that. Yeah, that's cool. Who cares if you lose a player or two because of the TV card? Just the price of doing business. And just about every single guy who has ever put on a pair of pads will tell you they know exactly what they signed up for. Violence. And a TV card positioned right near the field of play. Seems to me the game is dangerous enough without parking your TV cart right there on the sideline. Hell, why not just roll that bad boy right onto the field itself? I mean, after all, the networks are paying enormous bones to get these games. They have to have their shots. They've got to get these shots. And if it's going to cost a player or two, their leg or their life, who cares, right? We got to keep the main thing, the main thing. And the freaking TV card is apparently the main thing. Or they wouldn't have it right there on the sideline. I mean, damn, ESPN. Feel free to move that thing back a few feet before somebody loses their feet. All of that said, let's get down to the game. Let's get down to the game itself. And Alvin, I am going to need some music for this one. Today is the official start of fall. So give me that famous autumn bed that you like to bust out with on occasion. Alvi, that's the one. That's the one. Man, that was a macho performance by the Raiders. Yeah, I said it. You thought the Raiders were just going to open up a stadium and then watch the Saints open up a can of whoop-ass on them. You know you did. You know you did. And that's exactly how it looked when New Orleans opened up with a 10-point lead. That's how it looked, and that's how it felt. It felt like a boat race. Be honest. How many of you hit the Saints at -4 prior to kick and thought that you stumbled onto a pot of gold? I mean, seriously, be honest. Shoot straight. You thought the Saints would just march up and down the field. Yeah, the hell that was going to happen. I mean, sure, they looked a little flat early on. Yes, the Raiders were in trouble early on. Yes, it looked like they were just happy to be living the Death Star life. But then suddenly, the Raiders flipped the script. Suddenly, Derek Carr, who was sacked 3 times early on, got up off the mat and started doing things like this. An 11-play TD drive that he finished off with this.
Carr gets the snap, drop back and throw, and he has a wide-open fullback Ingold who caught the ball, spinning at the goal line, touchdown Las Vegas. Alec Ingold out of Wisconsin caught the ball, wide open, the fullback a decoy, and no one was around him, spinning with the catch belt high at the goal line, and the Raiders are on the board.
Westwood won, of course. Derek Carr started doing things like that. How about a 10-play TD drive? Then he finished off with this.
High shotgun snap, brings it down, pump fixes a line drive pass far side of the end zone. Diving catch made across the way. It was caught. Will they signal? It's a touchdown! Zay Jones, far side of the end zone, caught it on a dive and gets it to go for the Raiders.
Who are these guys? The hell is going on at the Death Star? And on both sides of the ball, no less. You pick off Drew Brees, then you go on an 8-play drive, capped off by a field goal as the half expires. So they go from being down 10-0 to going into the locker room tied up at 17-all. At that point, you know Raider Mike was absolutely lighting up the message boards after that half.
And you know
we were down 10, and now we're tied at 17. And it only got better for the silver and black in the second half. Raider Mike was doing what Raider Mike does, and Raider Mark was doing what he does, furiously thumbing out text messages to P.F. Chang's on his flip phone, looking to secure a post-win table to get grub on. Raider Mark. And it only got better for the silver and black in the second half. I literally could not believe what I was watching. They get the ball back to start. Then they go 9 plays for 75 more yards and this score.
They're going to go for it on 4th and goal. Snap, fake handoff, rolling his car to the end zone, throws, touchdown! Wide open the tight end, Darren Waller. 16 unanswered points by the Las Vegas Raiders. Wow!
Right? 16 unanswered points, 24-17. Then the defense forces another Saints punt. Vegas goes on a 12-play drive, but Derek Carr fumbles. Now I know what you're thinking. Here we go. Here come the real Raiders. Here's where the Raiders remember they're the Raiders. They're going to choke this one away. They're going to find a spectacular way to blow that 2-touchdown lead on national TV, in their Death Star, and gag it away. The Raiders will remember they're the Raiders. The hell they will, because the defense forced another punt. Then the offense goes on another monster drive. 10 plays, 89 yards, and it was capped off with this.
10, shotgun snap to Carr, pitches out to Richard, got a block from the guard, the 20 on the near side, got a block at the 15, at the 10, the 5, broke a tackle, down the sideline, touchdown Raiders! What a run by Richard! Whoa, what a play! 20-yard gallop where blocks were made and tackles were broken, and he rides right into the end zone for 6 for the Raiders.
All right, so if you're wondering why I keep saying how many plays, where's my music, Alvy? Come on, man! As I was saying, if you're wondering why I keep referencing how many plays the Raiders were running on their drives, it's because they were flat out dominating the Saints. That's a pretty damn good Saints defense. Or at least that was all the hype. And the Raiders were all about the ground and pound and mauling them on the ground. And then Derek Carr was picking them apart in the air. And that last TD was as brass as it gets. A 20-yard TD run is TD run on 3rd and 10 is brass as hell. That's a statement. That's a dude and a team imposing their will and sending a message. Message being, we are not the same slugs that we have been in the past. We're not getting punked. We're not getting punked any longer. Not in our house. Not on our Death Star. How many of you were laughing when Mark Davis opened up that stadium last month by saying, quote, "Welcome to the Death Star, where our opponent's dreams come to die." Yeah, well, nobody's laughing anymore. Most of all the Saints, who were completely outplayed, outhit, outclassed, outcoached. The Saints did not look like the Saints at all. And you can point to Drew Brees not being the player he once was. You know, and frankly, you'd be right. More on that in a minute. You can say that they're not the same team without Michael Thomas, and you would be right about that too. But the biggest reason the Saints did not look like the Saints is because the Raiders no longer look like the Raiders, at least not the Raiders that we've known. Did you ever think that you would see the day where Derek Carr would outplay Drew Brees? Did you ever think you'd see the day where John Gruden because both those things happened last night and the nation saw it. No, not the Raider Nation. I mean the actual nation, our nation. You know, from the Saints standpoint, I would love to say that'll happen. That's only one bad night. But given how bad of a night that was, I'm not sure that's one bad night. I'm not sure that's a one-off or an anomaly. You get up by 10, and then you're outscored 31-7 into a late TD? Man, that is bad. Really bad. When was the last time a Saints team coached by Sean Payton and quarterbacked by Drew Brees allowed somebody else to drop a 31-7 run on them? Ever? Here's a word that I never thought that I would use in describing a Sean Payton, Drew Brees offense. Anemic. Like, hey, Rome, use your words. Use your words, Rome. All right, I will. Anemic. And the defense wasn't much better. The defense could not get off the field, and the offense could not keep them off the field. And as rough a night as that was for the offense and the defense, man, their discipline, team discipline was even worse. The penalties were even worse for the Saints. 10 penalties, 129 yards, including the back-breaking PI on Janoris Jenkins in the fourth quarter. 10 penalties for 129 yards. Are you kidding me? That's what the Raiders do, not the Saints. Or at least that's what they used to do. Because the Raiders were practically perfect in that department. 3 penalties, 13 yards. The Saints led the league in penalties for the second straight week. All right, just so we're clear about one thing. I'm not here to kill the Saints. I'm here to hype the Raiders. The Las Vegas Raiders are 2-0, and they look damn good getting there. Josh Jacobs was running angry. Darren Waller being nearly unstoppable with 12 receptions for 103 yards and a TD. And remember all that heat that Derek Carr took from John Gruden himself and Raider fan. Yeah, well, that tune has changed. Here's Chunk. Here is Chunk on Carr.
This guy's a great quarterback, and we're surrounding him with better players. And once our defense, I think, starts playing to their potential, he can even be better. But, you know, he does so much with the ball and without the ball and behind the scenes that I think Raider fans should really be proud of him, and I know I am.
Derek Carr, tough as hell. I've been saying it since I first spoke to him when he was still in college. Yes, he's taken heat as a pro, but he has been through way worse than that. I mean, he is made of the right stuff now. He has made of some really tough stuff. And you knew this guy was not just going to give up or give in or roll over. I know he won't want to make it about him, but I will. He deserved that last night. He deserved to have a night like that on national TV. He deserved that shine. The only thing that would have made it better would have been Raider fan packed into that Death Star while their opponent's dreams died. What a good night for the Raiders. What a bad night for the Saints. Hey, listen, did you know that a fire department responds to a fire every 24 seconds? October is Fire Prevention Month, and we have teamed up with First Alert, the most trusted brand in fire safety, to help you be ready for the unexpected and to review some key safety tips. As an example, smoke and carbon monoxide alarms help provide an early warning in the event of a home emergency. And having enough First Alert smoke and carbon monoxide alarms is one of the best things that you can do for your home and your family. Also, remember, the alarms do not last forever, and they need to be replaced at least every 10 years. If you can't remember the last time that you replaced your alarm, it is best to replace that unit completely. And for a replacement option, my favorite is First Alert's combination smoke and carbon monoxide alarm with a 10-year sealed battery. This alarm provides 2-in-1 protection against smoke and carbon monoxide, and I don't have to change the battery for a decade. Lastly, take this time and discuss home safety with your family. And for more information on fire safety products, safety tips, and educational activities that you can do at home with your family, just visit firstalert.com/fireprevention month. firstalert.com/fireprevention month. He is Therese Paylor. Therese, what's going on? How are you?
Vance Mack, how's it going? Thanks for having me on again, man.
Dude, good to have you on. Always good to talk football with you. Hey, let me ask you first about Darren Waller. He had a huge game for the Raiders, but before we actually talk about that game, you had a great piece on him last week. Some people are familiar with that story, some are not. He's had a battle with addiction. For those who do not know the story, when did he first become addicted?
Back in his teens, Jim. Thanks for the compliment on the story, by the way. Back in his teens, growing up in suburban Atlanta, he's expounded upon this a little bit with Dan Pompeo, The Athletic, but you know, he had a lot of self-confidence issues. He didn't feel black enough, X, Y, and Z. He did things to try to fit in. It plagued him throughout his time at Georgia Tech, where he was very talented. I actually remember scouting him and evaluating him for my draft preview. I'm like, man, this guy's really talented. And he only went in the sixth round because of those issues. Drafted by the Ravens, again, very talented, but you know, the issues continued in Baltimore. He ultimately got help. He nearly overdosed. He got help after that. And has seemed to really turn the corner of his life and really, really touched it, tapped into some of his talent, and has made the most of it. Now, it's a day-to-day thing for Darren Waller now, but he's trying to pay it forward. He started the Darren Waller Foundation. He's got an upcoming gala coming up to try to raise money to help youth who are going through addiction struggles. And, you know, he's a guy who's easy to push for because he knows that he remains vulnerable. And he knows that on a day-to-day basis, this is a fight. But we've all got stuff we're fighting, Jim. And I think that's why it's so easy to root for him.
We're talking to Therese Paylor. I think that's very well said. You know, as you write, though, if you go back, he had, I mean, this is how bad this was. He had a near-death experience when he overdosed in his car in 2017. Where was he at that point in his life and his career?
I think he was lost. I think he was lost, and he's mentioned this before. You know, he had this golden opportunity in front of him to become a millionaire and play in the NFL and do things that, you know, millions wish they could do. But he was so lost in the throes of addiction, he didn't appreciate it. And, you know, he nearly lost his life because of it. And because of that moment, his nadir, he went to a great rehab facility. Now he's back. He earned a extension last October when it became apparent that this guy was a huge matchup problem. He has continued to get better, and he is somebody that last night they couldn't handle him. The Saints couldn't handle him with defensive backs, and you know he's too fast and too big for linebackers. So, you know, it's an awesome story to see a great football player show the kind of resilience and grit and perseverance that most people really, really appreciate. And again, it's a day-to-day battle.
Not only that,
really cool to see.
I was going to say, excuse me, not only that, he's fought that battle, he continues to fight that battle, and he's giving back. He starts a foundation in Vegas to help young people avoid or overcome addiction to drugs and alcohol. So, Therese, when you look at the Raiders overall, they fall behind 10-0, and if you don't know any better, you might think to yourself, same old Raiders, and then they drop a 31-7 run on the Saints. What do you make of the way the Raiders' offense and defense responded to that early start?
You know, I think this is a team that's rejuvenated a little bit. You know, this is Gruden's third season. And you look at what they've accomplished so far this year. They got a long way to go. But, you know, I think they're building. They've been building to this point where they know what they are offensively. They're going to be powered by Josh Jacobs. Derek Carr is going to protect the football and take shots here and there. He's going to throw to the fullback. He's going to throw to the tight end. And down the field, we're going to start seeing the young receivers we're really high on, Bryan Edwards and Henry Ruggs, you know, start making more of an impact in the pass game because they're going to have to for the Raiders to finish with a winning record. You know, defensively, you know, I'm not going to say this is the most talented team out there. I think they've still got a ways to go. But I see what they're building, right? In the secondary, they're big and they're fast. And in the defensive front, it's a lot better than it was even last year. So, you know, I think the best of John Gruden's Raiders is ahead. Their problem is they play in the same division as the Chiefs, which might be the best team in football.
Therese Paylor joining us. I'm going to try and get to the Chiefs in 1 minute. But before I leave this game, what did you make of what you saw from the Saints, and especially offensively without Michael Thomas?
Well, I was impressed with the way they were still able to get Alvin Kamara involved without Michael Thomas. Because when Thomas isn't on the field, Kamara's got to be the defensive point of emphasis. But he still had a very productive game, which I think speaks a lot to Sean Payton's game planning ability. But I was concerned that Drew Brees didn't push the ball down the field. You know, that's something that you know, they're going to have to do. Like, they're going to have to, without Michael Thomas, as long as he's hurt, you know, they're going to have to take some shots here and there. But, look, they're still a really well-schemed offense. Peyton still gets production out of those guys. I'd be surprised if they don't bounce back. I'm not at a point where I'm worried about the Saints. I still think that's, you know, arguably the most talented team in the NFC, and I think they're going to be right there at the end of the season.
Therese Paylor joining us once again. All right, so what about the Pats? They did not win on Sunday night, but how does Cam Newton look to you, both in terms of how he's fitting into the offense after two games and how he's throwing the ball?
Well, in general, Jim, the Patriots have believed in controlling the football game with their ground game and play action for the last several years. That's how they've been doing it under Tom Brady. The difference now is that they can expound upon it and throw some real cool wrinkles in there because of Cam Newton's size and running ability. Their quarterback power is deadly. They can run zone leap reads. They're using a lot of pre-snap motion to confuse the defense. And that's the thing, when you do those things effectively, as we've seen with the Rams a little bit, it doesn't matter if defenses know it's coming, because there's a lot they have to process. And if you make one mistake, that's a chunk game. So I actually think this is going to continue for the Patriots. I think through two games, what I've seen in Cam Newton is a player who should likely be considered the odds-on favorite to win Comeback Player of the Year. I see a quarterback who could very easily lead this team to 10 wins and a playoff win or two. The Patriots are going to be competitive and good all season. And I really, even though they lost on Sunday to the Seahawks, I'm really encouraged by what I see from them. The only thing that going to really come down to is can Cam stay healthy? And that's going to be the trick there. Nobody knows the answer to that.
We're talking to Therese Paylor. All right, back to the Chiefs. You mentioned them. Now, you are very familiar with that team. You've seen plenty of Patrick Mahomes. That Chargers defense gave Kansas City's offense some problems, and Mahomes still had more than 300 yards passing, 50 yards rushing. They get the win in overtime. I mean, how depressing is that for everybody in the AFC West that you can limit this guy, get up by double digits, and he's still going to find a way to come back and stab you in the heart?
You know, Jim, that's well said. That is, it's frustrating for sure, because that's about as bad as you'll see Mahomes play. And, you know, I talked about this on my podcast with Charles. Like, you know, there was still a feeling of inevitability throughout the course of that game. Like, oh, Chiefs get the ball back late. Well, Mahomes isn't going to let them lose. Like, it's Michael Jordan type stuff. Like, he doesn't let them lose games like that. I call them over my dead body games, where the team in general hasn't played very well. But if you give that guy a chance to stab you through the heart, he's going to do it. That's a special trait. And I'm just saying this. I'm sure you've got some listeners in Denver. He looks very, very much like John Elway in the mid-'80s. The only difference is Mahomes has already won his Super Bowl, right? And it's just an evolutionary Elway. And, yeah, that's a big compliment. But he's already won MVP. He's already won a Super Bowl. And you could even make a case that at this point he's already accomplished a lot of things. A lot of checklists you need to make the Hall of Fame. And he's just 25 years old. So special generational player, a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, I mean, there's a really distinct possibility that I might ask you this very question every single time you come on this show, but you laid out the credentials, and we're talking about a guy who just turned 25. He still has only started 33 regular season games. He really hasn't played the game that long. How do you explain what we're seeing from this guy?
Generational talent, you know, obviously, you know, you got to have the talent in you, but the thing he has going for him too is that the people around him, really strong. His trainer, Bobby Stroop, has helped him. Like, those throws he makes, he trains those throws. He practices that stuff. And also, his family has done an unbelievable job raising him. He's managed to stay humble throughout all this. And, you know, I think one thing that we really got to remember, that's a really big deal here, both his father and his godfather spent, you know, over 10 years in the big leagues. They played Major League Baseball. So Patrick got to spend time in clubhouses and see how A-Rod, see how Jeter approached their craft. And it's with diligence, hard work. There's no substitute for it. So he learned that. And also how to carry himself. And then he's got those guys giving him advice on how to carry himself in a locker room and how to lead, which explains how he's been such a good leader at 25. So really the perfect combination. And also, this is important, Jim, in football, quarterbacks also succeed because of the organization structure around them. he'd be good anyway, but he's great and generational and possibly transcendent because of the competent organization around him and a future Hall of Fame coach drawing it up and teaching. It takes all of it to become the greatest. But you can make a case that Mahomes has everything he needs to take a run in 6 rings.
Therese Paylor joining us. Six rings. That is a big, big number. I think you make a great point, too, about quarterbacks and what they need around them. They have to be in the right situation. There has to be a good fit. Most of all, they have to have the right organization. Where does that leave Russell Wilson as an example? Man, the guy looks absolutely unbelievable. How does he look to you, and does it feel like he might finally get an MVP vote or two this year?
I definitely think there's going to be a push for it because we all recognize how great of a football player he is, and it would be a shame if at the end of his career, and he will go into the Hall of Fame, he doesn't have an MVP. That's like an important, you know, tent pole for most quarterbacks, and he's certainly been good enough to win one at certain points. So, I think there's going to be a push for him to do it. You know, some of these other guys that can win it have already won it, and in general, I do think some people want to spread it around. So he looks great. It looks like the Seahawks are going to let him cut it loose a little bit more. He didn't cut it loose in week two like he did in week one, but it was still, he was throwing a healthy amount, even though the Seahawks were very balanced. I think it's certainly possible we could be looking at the Russell Wilson career year. He has the weapons around him to do it. The receiving core is very good. I think DK Metcalf's taking a step up. I've always liked Tyler Lockett. And then the secondary receivers have been good too. So, yeah, I think Seattle is on its way to a big season, especially with the struggles San Francisco's had staying healthy. And I think that Russell Wilson will keep this up, and he's going to be right there in the MVP race at the end, and he will deserve it.
Hey, Trez, one quick thought before you go. If you're the Cowboys, how are you feeling after that win on Sunday? For instance, do you feel good and that things are headed in the right direction after that comeback? Or are you pretty concerned about falling behind 20-0 and trailing by 15 with 5 minutes to go and looking at an 0-2 start? I mean, who are they?
I'm feeling relief because 0-2 in Dallas with this team and this roster would be a disaster. And that's when you start getting organizational input if you're coaching staff.
I'm right.
So, yeah. So I think it was really important for them, you know, just for Mike McCarthy's program to just start 1-1 and not 0-2. That would be a big deal down there. So, look, you're concerned, right, because I think Atlanta's competitive, and they actually have a really good offense, but as you saw, their defense leaves some things to be desired. I think I'd be relieved in like, all right, let's get to work. And here's one thing to remember, too. This is very important, Jim. They were out there top three offensive tackles. So that was a devastating loss to Atlanta in the sense that you get up 20-0, their tackles are – the Cowboys' tackles are completely unproven. You know they're going to have to throw it a little bit, and you still blow the lead. Whew, it's hard to come back from that in the NFL, Jim. So
yeah,
if I'm Dallas, I take pride in that.
Hey, check this out. Are you looking for some new content? Peacock is the new streaming service from NBC Universal. Great entertainment is finally free. Peacock has live sports, daily highlights, timely docuseries, and exclusive access to Premier League. And the best of live events, 2020-2021 Premier League season, with over 175 exclusive matches live streamed on Peacock. Plus, coverage of the U.S. Open live from Wingfoot from September 17th through the 20th. Exclusive streaming destination of the 2021 Olympics as well. Real stories, beautifully told documentaries that tell the otherwise untold stories of grit, perseverance, and triumph behind the athletes we love. I'm talking about the best of streaming, best of TV. You can watch for free and upgrade for more on your TV, tablet, or phone. Go to peacocktv.com to download and start streaming now.
Robert Kraft, billionaire, CEO, NFL owner, Teddy Roosevelt Award winner, 6-time Super Bowl champ. Pretty impressive resume. But I'm not sure any of that compares to the victory that he is now standing on the precipice of because yesterday's announcement out of the Florida State court system may be even better than any Lombardi trophy that Jim Nance has ever handed to him. According to the AP, prosecutors in his solicitation case have announced that they will not
They will not appeal the court's decision to block the undercover surveillance videos that allegedly show old Bobby paying for and receiving massage parlor sex acts. The decision prompted the New York Post to go all New York Post with it because their headline read yesterday, and I quote, "Robert Kraft likely to get off in Florida massage parlor case," end quote. Well played. Kinda. Sorta. Not really. Did a clone write that headline? If you have not been paying attention to the now nearly two-year-old case, Kraft's high-priced team of suits allegedly, check that, successfully argued that the videos allegedly catching their client with his pants down inside the Orchids of Asia Day Spa in Jupiter, Florida, were illegally recorded, therefore in violation of privacy rights. Turns out the police working the beat left the camera rolling for way longer than they were permitted to do so under law. And in so doing, they recorded and viewed things outside of their warrant. Kraft's lawyers were then able to suppress the video and get it to be ruled inadmissible in the case against him. Which means, even though Kraft publicly apologized for his actions, even though what everybody thinks is on the tape pretty much clearly is on the tape, none of it can be used against him. Court of public opinion, sure. Court of law, nope. And since the video is the only evidence that the state has against Kraft, he's going to beat this rap. Because no video means no case. And with the announcement, their prosecutors are not going to appeal the court's decision to block the video, it means that all charges against Bobby likely will be dropped any second now. It also means a few more things. The first is I do have to give a clone, Kevin in Appleton, some credit for calling this exact outcome the day the story broke. You might recall this call. Let's go to Appleton, Wisconsin. Kevin.
I just think that if there is videotape evidence, I think the videotape's going to disappear. That's how I see this thing playing out, and then he's going to somehow figure out a way to get out of this mess. It just seems like that's the way things go, and it's high-profile people.
Take a victory lap, Kev. You nailed that. The second thing this means, my guy, two-time Super Bowl champ, Trevor Price, is probably never going to get the viewing party that he so desperately coveted.
Holy hell, man. If that hits the interwebs, good night.
Trevor, does that mean that if that leaks, you're not going to watch it, or you are?
Oh, I'm in line. I am in line. I tell my wife, move over, let me get a look.
Move over, let me get a look? What, an old rich guy in his junk? Pour one out for Trev. Tough day for the big fella. What this also means is the 20 others who were also caught on video doing what Kraft did are also going to skate, because these randos and non-billionaires are going to benefit from Kraft's legal team, who fought tooth and nail for 2 years to get the video thrown out. You want to talk about some good fortune? Try landing on the same police surveillance tape with your pants down as Robert Kraft. Because as soon as Kraft was on the tape, his extremely expensive lawyers were doing everything they could to get it suppressed and get it tossed, which they did. And the court's not just throwing out the pants with Kraft on it. They're throwing the book. They're not throwing the book at the other 20 dudes who are allegedly doing the same thing. Like, you get what you pay for, generally. Those randos were paying for the legal dream team that Kraft was stroking checks for, and they didn't have to pay for it. They benefited from it. So it's a very good day for Kraft and a great day for everybody else on that tape, who essentially had the best lawyers in the world working for them, and they did not have to pay for it. In other words, it's like this thing never actually happened, which also means it's like these phone calls from 2 years ago also never actually happened.
I just want to let you know, I seen Bob Kraft hustling a couple of your sponsors, man. He was out here hanging up posters for Untuck It outside the local rub and tug day spa.
I'm going to go ahead and dub this scandal Open Flygate. This dude's not on his first wife. He's been picked up for a DUI, and he's now involved in prostitution. He's one stack of AK-47s away from being inducted to the Dallas Cowboys Ring of Honor. I guess NFL owners only care about kneeling when it's their players?
What was Kevin Frazier's take on how the lady Robert Kraft was paying to punch his clown down at the Rub-A-Dicky Day Spa was named Wang?
I heard that the release of the video is being held up in the court. That release has been held up because Michael Crichton, who's the creator of Jurassic Park, has filed a copyright violation lawsuit. The defendants in the case said that the lawsuit's ridiculous because where the Jurassic Park logo is the entire skeleton of a Tyrannosaurus Rex, the Jurassic Pork logo consists of only one old bone.
You don't like that cup. I don't like that cup. Jurassic Pork? One old bone? Those calls never happened. Because that videotape apparently does not exist. If Kraft can get a video thrown out altogether, I can get some audio thrown out altogether. Delete the audio, Alvin. The moral of the story is this. There really are two types of people in the world. People with money and people without money. And the people with money almost always get over. Even if they did exactly what everybody knows they did, but nobody can prove. Even if we know. Two types of people in the world. People with money and people without money. Actually, two more types of people in the world. Lucky perverts and unlucky perverts. Every lucky pervert has his day. Even a lucky pervert finds an acorn once in a while. They got off. Aaron Jones is my guest. Aaron, great to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing good, and you?
Good, good. In fact, let me rephrase that. You're 2-0. You're in first in the division. You're putting up enormous numbers. You're holding the Snickers chain, which I'll get to in a moment. Overall, how is life for you right now?
Life's good. I have no complaints. I'm blessed, and everything's going great.
All right, so let's talk about what happened this past weekend. You're coming off a game where you had 236 yards from scrimmage. That's a team record for a running back. Last year, you set a team record for TDs in the regular season and the playoffs combined. When you know the history of the team you play for, what does it mean to you to be setting team records in Green Bay? How much pride do you have in that fact?
I have a lot of pride. You know, it's a historic team been around for so long. I mean, first season was 1919, and so it was even before the first NFL season. So, I mean, there's a lot of history there, and to come in and be a part of that history is something special.
Aaron Jones joining me. You know, I would imagine you have your process, you have your preparation, you do the same sorts of things every single week to get ready for a game. And then you have a game like that where you rush for a career-high 186 rushing yards. I mean, did you know going into that game that you had something special like that in you? Did you see that coming in any way?
That's what I'm trying to achieve every game. But my brother, he told me, he's like, I need 2 touchdowns. And I told him I was feeling it that day. I was like, I got you for 3. And you have a great week of practice, and I believe the hard work pays off that you put in throughout the week, and it showed on Sunday.
Packers running back Aaron Jones, my guest. The biggest highlight of that game was your career-long 75-yard touchdown run. Can you take us through that? What did you see, and how did it feel to break free like that?
Our left guard and left tackle, and then our center, they were working a combo, and actually the center, Corey Linsley, he had a backer shoot right at him, and he picked him up, and our left guard, Elton Jenkins, and David Bakhtiari were on a combo block, a double team up to the second level backer, and they got up to him, and I was just kind of able to run through the line and go right around them, and I seen it was two hot safeties, and they were split in the middle of the field, and I knew I could just beat them with speed, and kind of made the miss and just took it to the house.
Aaron Jones breaking it down for us. And then you had Aaron Rodgers, and he was just pumped. He was hyped about your performance. He was saying things like, quote, that's pretty amazing. He's such a talented guy. He does so many things for our offense. And then Aaron was also fired up about your receiving as well, including that grab where you were split out wide on a corner and high pointed it in coverage. Quote, that was a pretty spectacular catch. Him high pointing that, and it was tight coverage. It wasn't a ball I second guessed at all. That's all credit to him. End quote. What about that play? What did you see on that play? Take us through that one, too.
Yes, sir. So, I mean, A-Rod called the play on the huddle, and he always tells us just to be ready, you know. Most of the time when running backs are out there, they don't get a lot of respect. So he was like, just always stay ready. You never know when that ball is coming. And I'm running my route, and I start looking back at the ball and tracking it, and I see it coming, and I just – thinking, catch the ball in any way I can catch it. My mom always told me when I was little, if the ball touches your hands, you got to catch it. So that's all that was going through my mind.
All right, so we're talking about a lot of things here now. You're running wild. You're making plays, split out. But there's also a play where you picked up a blitzing Lions linebacker to buy some time for Aaron Rodgers to complete a 41-yard pass play to Marquez Valdez-Scantling. What about that? How much pride did you take in that play?
I mean, I take a lot of pride in holding our quarterback up. I mean, keeping them clean and protection, it just has to be a mentality. Like you said, it has to be a pride thing. You got to want to keep your quarterback clean. You know, you don't want him taking a lot of hits. And so for me, it's a major pride thing in keeping him clean, and not just for me, but the O-line as well. We all take pride in keeping 12 upright and clean with the clean jersey at the end of the game.
Aaron Jones, my guest, you know, I would imagine you guys all, that's all part of the job, right? You got to keep your quarterback clean no matter who your QB1 is. But when your quarterback is that guy, is there a little extra pride, a little extra effort? You're going to be professional no matter what. But when you're trying to keep that guy clean, does everybody go the extra mile because of who he is?
I definitely think so. I mean, it's a future Hall of Famer that you're blocking for. So you definitely don't forget that. You know, if you give him the time, he'll make the defense pay. So we just do our job and try to give him enough time.
Aaron, you know, I'm looking at your production, and you and I have talked in the past, but for all the production you've had, I'm still blown away by the fact that there are still some people overlooking you. How much do you notice that, and is that something that motivates you?
I've noticed it ever since I've been playing football, and it's kind of been a constant for me, just being overlooked. So I definitely use it as fuel to the fire, chip on the mountain on my shoulder, and just let it keep adding up, and let my play do the talking.
Well, it's certainly doing that. Now, knowing that you've got that year under your belt in this system, how much better can this offense overall still get? I mean, like, how high is the ceiling for this team?
I think it's still pretty high. I mean, we left some plays out there. All the receiving core, when I say receiving core, running back, tight ends, receivers, we had some drops out there. So it's some things we can definitely clean up and get sharper. I think you're 3-for-5 in the red zone. So, I mean, you want to be perfect. So, there's room to clean that up as well. And so I think we're making the right strides, but just going to continue to work to where we want to be.
Packers running back Aaron Jones joining me for a couple of more moments. Now, for as good as you looked on the field Sunday, I've got to ask you about the sunglasses you were rocking after the game. They were amazing. What is the story behind those shades?
Yes, sir. So I recently signed with Oakley, and they sent them to me, and I was supposed to wear them the first game coming off the bus, and I kind of forgot. And so I was like, if I score, I'm going to throw them on. And somebody asked me, are you going to do it next week? And I was like, yeah, why not? I mean, plan on getting in the end zone, so why not? And so I just have them on the sideline and pull them out every time I get in the end zone.
I like it. It's a great look. Speaking of great looks, as I mentioned off the very top, you are currently the holder of the Snickers chain. It goes to the league's hungriest player each week. First off, what is that award about? And then how much does it mean to you to receive that award?
Yes, sir. It feels great to be the second player awarded the Snickers chain this season, which is, like you said, is passed around the league each week to the hungriest player. Just like last season, the chain is, like you said, awarded. And I was trying to get my hands on this chain last year, so I'm definitely honored to be able to pick it up early in the season in week two, and I definitely look to be rocking it some more this year. And fans can also check out my Instagram to see the chain and follow hashtag Snickers Chain on social media to see which player gets it each week throughout the season.
Dude, life is good. You've got numbers. You've got the chain. Packers off to a great start. He is Aaron Jones, appearing courtesy of Snickers and the Snickers chain. And that chain makes it stop with him this week. And as Aaron just said, he's looking to get it back before the end of the year. Aaron, always good to have you on the show. Appreciate you. That was a great game. And I'll look forward to talking to you again soon because I know we will.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you.
Hey, clones, I want to talk to you about Goody's Hangover Powder. Now, do you know about this product? This is incredible. Goody's understands that you cannot afford to let a hangover slow you down. And for a hangover that is really tough, you need real medicine. Goody's Hangover is more than just natural supplements that you've seen before for treating hangovers. With a history that's rooted in analgesics and putting an end to tough pain, Goody's Hangover has the right formula to stop pain fast and to provide a boost of alertness. So now you can have that fun night without worrying about the next morning. This is the first of its kind. A first hangover offering from an analgesics brand. And it temporarily relieves minor aches and pains due to a hangover, headache, muscle aches. And it helps to restore mental alertness when experiencing fatigue or drowsiness associated with a hangover. I mean, have we not all been there? And it comes in a tasty berry citrus boost flavor. Toss it back or mix with water. Goody's Hangover. Real medicine for real hangovers. Fast relief with a boost of alertness as well. It's available on Amazon, in Walmart, and at your local convenience store.
And you know,
he knows more about the Raiders and what makes them go and how they were built and how they execute then I would argue almost anybody in the organization. We go there right now. Mike, what's going on?
That's smack. Thanks for taking the call, dude. Hey, epic start for the Silver and Black. Raider Nation flooded Vegas last weekend in style for our first game in the new Death Star. And, you know, even our fake fans were louder than a regular Charger crowd. Huge watch party at the Stage Door Casino with my boy Homer Cody and Kenny King Jr. I'd be remiss if I did not come in today and spike that football. First, props to our quarterback. One of the best games I've seen him play since the Thursday night miracle. Excellent play calling at the line. He rarely checked into a bad look, took advantage with that offensive line with the running game. And, dude, he was dealing dimes. Now, if he could only scramble on third down. And shout out to the rotund one with the extra large huevos, Jim, who demonstrated to those knuckleheads, Mike McCarthy and Anthony Lynn, the proper time and place to roll the dice. Huge stones to kick that field goal, man. And I would say hardly a vote of confidence for our defensive coordinator. In fact, with Rod Marinelli in town, Gunther is not unlike that French dude in the Green Mile. You know, the guy with the circus mouse. As Chicky Baby used to say, that guy, he ain't long for this one. Last thing, Van Smack. I mean, how sweet is it for old-school Raider fans like myself to finally be on the living side of that double-edged sword with penalties? I mean, the Aints racked up 10 penalties for $1.29 in true Raider fashion. Five of those led directly to Raider first downs. And we had 17 of those all last year. And speaking of the Zebras real quick, so I'm on Twitter after the game, Jim. I'm counting coup big time. And here's the JTP and all its glory yucking it up on down judge Sarah Thomas. I mean, just this week, we buried a great American in RBG. And yet, here comes the jokes on making sandwiches for the other refs at halftime or doing the friggin' dishes. I mean, look, that lady had a solid game. She was decisive, never out of position, ponytail flying around. She wasn't afraid to drop that hammer, drop that flag. And besides, man, I just love blondes. That's all I got, dude. I'll talk to you soon.
Raider Mike.
And you know,
let's go to Scotty in San Francisco. What's going on, Scotty? How are you?
Hello, you doing, Jim? I want to, if you can, call you the bartender. I called you about a year ago. Told you if you're ever up in Northern California, I'll shake your James Bond blue sapphire for you get it nice and chill with the nice stuff. Blue.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Hey, bro. I appreciate that you want to do something nice for me. That if I were to get to the Bay Area, since you work at a bar and you're a bartender, you'll shake me up a nice Bombay Sapphire. Although I haven't really had a Bombay Sapphire in, I mean, I almost want to say years. I moved off that thing. But you know what I have not moved off of? No self-glossing. even if it's a self-gloss that would somehow benefit me. Notice I said, let's go to Scotty in San Francisco. Notice what I did not say. I did not say, let's go to the bartender in San Francisco. Because as far as I'm concerned, Scotty, you're Scotty. Now, had I gone to the Bay Area and dropped into a bar, and Scotty, you sound like a really good dude, but rules are rules. Now, if I had gone to the Bay Area and I had bumped into you in a bar and you were to say to me, yo, Rome, dude, oh man, it's good to have you here. Listen, here's what I want to do for you because you have provided so many hours of amazing listening. I want to shake you up some of the magic blue. You good with that? And I might say, you know what, man, that is so nice. Yes. Yes, please. Thank you very much. And if I were to smash that Bombay Sapphire Martini, and it was a great one, I might say, you know what, bro? You from here going forward are going to be known as the bartender. I probably would come up with a better gloss myself, but if that were the one that I came up with, then if you called the show, I would say, yo, my man, the bartender in San Francisco. Or better yet, even, the bartender in Frisco. Because I know you guys love it when we gloss you Frisco. Instead, we never had that experience. And even though you just said that if I were to show up, that would be the experience never actually transpired. Therefore, you are Scotty in San Francisco. I address you as such. You correct me with self-glossing. And now I would like to introduce you, Scott, to all your new friends.
Levi the Trash Man.
Dice Man.
Loney Carter in Spokane.
The Axe.
Bighorn Bowling Ball.
Jay Dizzle.
Manny Cheeseburger over here.
Shakala is Van City.
Lone Prophet.
The Grump.
The Grouch.
Mole Doggy in NorCal.
The Dougler.
Zookeeper.
Roaster. Garbage Man, Brad.
The Cracker Jack.
G-Money. Sexy Rexy from New Mexico.
The Red Dog.
Horse Monkey. Tree Frog.
G-Money.
B-Man. SD. Bow Down.
Z-Man. Cotton
Woman. His Silly Rabbit.
Barracuda.
The Muscle Shark.
Denver John.
The Horse Whisperer.
Main Man here.
I need you guys to call me the Bread Man.
His Silly Rabbit.
Well, if you can't call me the bartender.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
All members of an extremely exclusive club. He is Pierre Maguire. Pierre, my friend, great to have you back in the jungle. How are you?
Oh, Jim, it's awesome to be in the jungle with you. How are you doing?
Great, great. Things are great here, and it's great to talk some hockey with you as always. In fact, the Cup Final, Pierre, is underway. What is it like having the final played in the bubble and without fans? Does it feel surreal, or by now are you used to it?
No, it feels surreal, I'll be honest with you, but I think the players have adapted to it over the course of time. These two teams have been in their bubbles, respectively, for almost 8 weeks now, so they understand exactly what it's all about. You have to generate your own enthusiasm. You don't have a lot of noise, even though they do have some piped-in noise, which I think the NHL's done a fantastic job with, to try to create more of a realistic game-type environment. But there's still no fans, and where you really feel it, Jim, is in the warm-up. Usually there's a lot of electricity in the building before a hockey game, especially during a Stanley Cup final game. You really don't feel that, and that's where it's a little bit different. But then eventually the players adapt and they start playing the game the way they know it to be played, and it becomes pretty intense, like we saw last night in Game 2 between Dallas and a well-prepared Tampa Bay team for Game 2 last night.
Pierre Maguire joining us. You know, I think adapt is the key word right there. When you're talking about NHL players, these guys pretty much have been doing this their whole life. They adapt, they change, they do what they have to do. Pierre, you're extremely regimented yourself. I know you're not looking to make it about you, but I'm curious, what has the experience of the bubble been like for you personally?
Most unique experience I've ever had in 32 years in the National Hockey League, Jim, I can tell you that. But I would say this, the healthcare professionals here have been over the top great. The hotel workers, the restaurant workers have been phenomenally hospitable. But what makes me the most proud and really helps enhance my experience has been the professionalism of our players, our coaches, our trainers, and everybody that's around the sport. I've been blown away, Jim, by the commitment of everybody. I mean, I was with a player yesterday walking out of the rink. He's got a three-month-old child at home and a wife, and he knew he had to come and do this for his team. And just the way he handled it, just the way he wasn't complaining, wasn't making any, you know, bad statements about anything. He says, listen, this is what we had to do for the well-being of the game. and I'm prepared to sacrifice for that. And I really respect the attitude of everybody that's been part of the bubble situation. It's not easy, Jim, I'll be honest with you, but everybody that's been part of it, I haven't heard any complaining or backbiting or negativity.
Well said. Pierre McGuire is joining us. All right, in terms of the series itself, Pierre, Tampa Bay dropped the first game of the Final 4-1, then they come back in Game 2. They score three times in the first period. How significant a statement was that from Tampa Bay?
It was significant, Jim. They were prepared to make some changes in their game, number one. Number two, they took a little bit of the momentum they gathered in the third period of Game 1, where they outshot Dallas 20-3, and even though they didn't win Game 1, they carried some of that enthusiasm and momentum into Game 2. But they did three things that were really important. They changed their power play. They went from a conventional power play with two defensemen on the back end and then three-fourths up front to playing what's called a 1-3-1, so only one defenseman back, three forwards across the top of the hash marks or the circles, and then one posting up in front of the opposition goalie. That led to two goals in the first period. It was really a smart schematic by them. The second adjustment they made, they played a right-wing lock in the neutral zone. That allowed their defense to stay up, forced Dallas to shoot the puck in, and they had enough time to go back and get the puck. So that's a second change that they made. And then the third change is, rather than trying to carry the puck through the neutral zone because of the way Dallas plays, they play fantastically well in the neutral zone, Jim. They, rather than trying to carry it, they got to the red line, they chipped it deep, and then they started the forecheck. So they made three substantial changes to their game plan, and it really paid dividends. Now, they lost their way a little bit in the second period and definitely in the third period, but they found a way to win, and that's the most important thing. But they can take a lot of confidence out of the way their coaching staff prepared them for Game 2 and try to carry some of that into Game 3.
Pierre McGuire joining us. You know, you answered two of my questions. I was going to say to you, how significant was it that the first two goals came on the power play? You addressed that. I was going to say, how different did they look in terms of the way they handled and managed the puck? You answered that. Let me ask you about Andre Vasilevsky. How did he look in goal for Tampa last night to you?
Man, Jim, you know, I heard you talking about NBA and NFL and how much you've been talking about that. This is a guy, along with Victor Hedman, their star defenseman, by the way, both those players are so big, they're so athletic, they're so skillful. They could walk into any dressing room, whether it be in the NFL, Major League Baseball, into the NBA. Most hockey players have different body types in those other sports, but not those two guys. They could both walk into an NFL room, and most people would think they'd be tight ends or outside linebackers. I mean, they're just so amazingly athletic and well-built. But I thought Vasilevsky was tremendous last night, and he has been all playoff. I mean, you could count on the number of fingers, maybe on one hand, how many bad goals he's given up the entire playoff. I mean, he has not given up very many bad goals.
We are talking to Pierre McGuire. All right, Pierre, what about Steven Stamkos? He participated in the morning skate yesterday, did not play last night. What is your expectation in terms of when he might return and what kind of an impact he'll have when he does return?
I don't know when he'll be back, Jim. It's not really fair to speculate only because it's such a guarded secret with injuries. And this is a band that hasn't played since February. So, you know, you're talking about a long period of time now. I think the biggest thing with Steven is if he were to come back, he would help them on the power play, which is already starting to get going here. And really has been a strength of the Tampa Bay Lightning until this playoff season where it has not been as good. But I think Steven would help him on the power play. I know one thing. He desperately wants to get back. He's worked his tail off to get back. But to say that he'd be able to help him 5-on-5, I think would be a stretch at this time of the year, having not played for as long as he's missed. But he could definitely help them on the power play.
We're talking to Pierre McGuire. All right, so what about Dallas, Pierre? Like, Tyler Seguin had not had a goal or an assist since Game 3 of the Colorado series. You know, as you just point out, you never want to speculate about injuries. But does he look right to you? Is he just in a slump? Or is he fighting through something else, perhaps?
I think he's battling through something else, and he's too proud a guy to say anything to anybody. And, you know, I've had some pretty significant chats with him. I really respect him a ton. I'll never forget the day he got cut by Team Canada back at the 2010 World Junior, being at the airport with him in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, and just seeing him cry and how emotional it was for him. He had never been cut from any team before in his life, obviously, and he cares so much about the game. He cares so much about being a good teammate. You know, a year later, he was playing for the Boston Bruins and helped them win a Stanley Cup in 2011. I really feel badly for him because people don't know. I think he is going through something significant in terms of an injury situation. We'll find out when it's all said and done. But one of the things I can say, Jim, is he usually has a really explosive first two steps. I don't see that anymore, and I think that's part of what's ailing him. but he's doing other things to help the team. He's killing penalties. He's blocking shots. He's taking big faceoffs. He's trying to make hard plays on goal. So I really respect that part of what he's trying to accomplish right now.
We're talking about the NHL Stanley Cup Final. Pierre McGuire breaking it down. You know, Pierre, if we were to take a step back, the fact that Dallas is here is pretty remarkable when you consider the fact that coaching change in December and Rick Bonus was named interim head coach. What do you make of the job that he has done since taking over?
Well, I'll be biased on this because I worked with Rick in Ottawa. I have tremendous respect for him. He's one of three men that's coached in 5 decades in the National Hockey League. Mm. Only the late Pat Quinn and Scottie Bowman have done that. That's an amazing accomplishment unto itself. The thing that I like about Rick is the way he is with his players. They trust him, they respect him, and his message doesn't deviate. So he doesn't set you up one day for this, and then the next day he goes in a whole other direction. There's no bait and switch with Rick Bonus. You know exactly what you're getting. The biggest thing that the Dallas Stars remind me, Jim, and you'll remember this, the 2012 and the 2014 LA Kings that won the Stanley Cup. In 2012, they replaced their coach with Terry Murray with Daryl Sutter, and he came in and engineered this unbelievable comeback to get them in the playoffs and eventually win the Stanley Cup. Dallas reminds me of that team. Dallas reminds me of the 2014 team of L.A. They're big, they're physical, they're deep. They play a certain structured way in the neutral zone. They play a structured way in their own zone. They're getting amazing goaltending from Anton Hudobin, just like L.A. got from Jonathan Quick. So it reminds me a lot of those L.A. teams that were really good in 12 and in 14. But to me, the big job that Rick's done, level of communication and delegating authority. He's got really good assistants. Johnny Stevens, one of his assistants, was an assistant with that Kings team. He delegates fantastically well to everybody. Rick's done a really good job.
Also, Todd Nelson, another assistant, and he works really well with them. You know, I'm kind of amazed by this. Like, I mean, the guy's a legend. As you point out, he's coached in 5 different decades. But there's the fact that he is an interim coach, and because he has that tag, you think that players maybe might not respond the way they are or maybe respect him as much. But, Peter, when you get right down to it, how isn't every single NHL coach an interim coach, and how much does the title actually matter to the players?
One time, many, many moons ago, Jim, I was at a press conference in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, with the winningest coach in the history of the National Hockey League, Scottie Bowman. He was being named interim head coach, and I was being named assistant coach with the Penguins. And one of the writers asked him, what's it like to be Scottie Bowman and be named interim head coach? And his answer was as good as any answer I've ever heard off the spot. He said, every coach in this league is interim. And you couldn't be more right. And the players know that. And, you know, the NHL, for most of us, stands for the National Hockey League, but for coaches, not here long is really what it stands for.
Well, if Scotty were to answer that question, Scottie Bowman of all people, then you know that that's what that is. So Game 3, Pierre, is tomorrow night, and then you've got Game 4 on Friday, Game 5 on Saturday. How much of a challenge will that back-to-back be for a Game 4 and a Game 5?
Fantastic question, and I know it was a negotiated point of view because a lot of people thought the back-to-back was going to be between Game 2 and Game 3, but now it's between 4 and 5, so it's going to matter in terms of the health of your roster, and especially if this becomes the ultimate battle of attrition, which usually is what happens, and we started to see fragments of that last night in Game 2. If that continues in Game 3 and then into Game 4, then I think it becomes very difficult. So if you have a lot of momentum, usually momentum doesn't transfer from game to game. Over the course of the Stanley Cup final, it may transfer for a half a period or so, but not game to game. But if this goes to become a battle of attrition, which it looks like it's going to be, whomever wins Game 4 probably will have significant energy going into Game 5, and that should matter a lot in a back-to-back.
Pierre, one last thought. You mentioned Scottie Bowman, so I want to ask you something like this. Somebody sent me a clip that I put up on my Instagram feed last week, and it was of Wayne Gretzky in the locker room after they beat the Toronto Maple Leafs in the conference finals in a Game 7, and he looked directly into the camera and he said, quote, to my good friend Jim Rome, we still have the karma. And I remember thinking, it stopped me in my tracks back then, but that was Wayne Gretzky. He had come to L.A., and almost he took it upon himself to help teach the region about hockey, which brings me to Scottie Bowman. Scottie Bowman, Peter, would always come on this show, which always blew my mind, and then I once did an appearance, one of my tour stops in Buffalo in the summertime, and Scottie showed up for that. What is it about the sport and the powers that be that take it personally to not only embrace it, but to share it? Like, those two things still to this day blow my mind, but maybe it shouldn't, given the sport and the people within the sport, if you know what I mean.
I totally know what you mean. And by the way, I talk to Scotty probably every other day and have for the last 35 years. He's 87 years of age. Mm. Just turned that last Friday.
Wow.
He's doing fantastically well. He goes between Buffalo and Sarasota, Florida. He still goes to a ton of games. He works for the Chicago Blackhawks as a consultant. He's so vibrant. He's so plugged in. I think the biggest thing is that people in our sport usually come from humble beginnings, and they really care about growing the game. We know we're the underdog in a lot of different markets, so people really care about trying to grow the game and show the personality of the players that are part of it and the coaches that are part of it and the people that really care about it. And, you know, I can tell you in our community, Jim, you matter a ton. And I'm not saying that because I'm on your show. I tell this to people all the time. Your passion for our sport and the way you treat the people that come on that talk about our sport is phenomenal. And everybody in our community really appreciates that. So I'm going to say thank you for everybody.
Pierre, I want to say thank you very much for saying that. And I certainly don't need to hear that, but that makes me feel very good to hear that. But, you know, as I mentioned, as a kid growing up in Los Angeles, strangely enough, and I have no idea why my father did this, but we had season tickets not only to the LA Kings back in the day, the Triple Crown line days before Gretz got here, but for whatever reason, and I have no idea why my father did this, Pierre, we had season tickets to the LA Sharks. Why my dad was a WHA guy back in the day, I have no idea, but we would go to the sports arena and see the LA Sharks play. So I grew up on that game, even here in Los Angeles, where the sport was not big early on. I loved it from day one. I knew from day one this was a very different game played by very different athletes.
Yeah, that's such an awesome story. I love hearing that. And, you know, it probably says a little bit about where you got your persona from, Jim. Sounds like your dad was a guy that wasn't afraid to cut against the grain, which is really cool and I think really neat. I watched tons of WHA games when I was a kid growing up in Montreal, and there were some great players that came out of that league. Obviously, Wayne Gretzky was one of them. Michel Goulet was another one of them. I mean, you go down the line, you look at what some of the players that came out. Gordie Howe played in the WHA. You look at some of the great players that played in that league. Jerry Cheevers. There were some phenomenal. Vladdy Nedimansky, who just got into the Hockey Hall of Fame. So, no, there's some great WHA stories. But that was a league that probably wasn't going to be very successful because they just didn't have the deep pockets that were necessary to try to compete against the NHL.
Pierre, it's so funny. Like the things that come rushing back to you as like a kid. Like I remember my father was, he passed away long ago. He had cancer, he had leukemia, but he loved sports and he was a big sports, Boston sports fan. We would go to the WHA games, and don't ask me why I remember this as a little kid, Pierre, but I remember him saying to me, Bart Crashley. Now that's a great name. Bart Crashley. Why that sticks with me, I don't know. But I do also remember going into the Forum Club after Kings games back in the day when my guy Dave Hutchison was back on the blue line. Neil Komodowski was playing for the LA Kings. I mean, these were good, good times as a kid growing up watching the game.
The one thing that I missed the most about when I visited LA, the Forum Club being gone. Well, not, I don't miss the Forum, but I missed the Forum Club.
Wasn't that
I
fun?
I think everybody else does too.
Well, especially back then, like before Gretz got here, Pierre, now you and I are just kind of riffing, but back then when Rogie Vachon would walk into the Forum Club, you know, and there were only 7,000-8,000 people a night when they were in the Purple Gold, man, Rogie was larger than life, man. There was some charisma to that man.
Absolutely. Still is. I tried to recruit his son, Nick, to play for college hockey for me at St. Lawrence University, so I've known the family a while, and Nick was a good player and went on to play at Boston University. But no, you know what? I love talking hockey with you, Jim. I could talk about hockey with you all day long.
Pierre,
it's a delight. It really is.
We once went to a lunch for the Kings, and Rogie was there, and Rogie was kind of like one of the ambassadors, and it was a lunch, and Rogie had, I don't know, Rogie had a martini, but like in a normal cocktail glass with about 30 olives. And he was just doing his thing. And he's got his kind of like French-Canadian charm going. And Janet's kind of mesmerized by the whole thing. And Janet goes, that was a very charming man. I'm like, Rogie? Yeah, hell yes, he's a charming man. He's great. You should see him between the pipes. But those were good times. Pierre, thank you for indulging me on my childhood and growing up with the sport. Those were good times. It's always good to talk hockey with you right now. I appreciate you. I appreciate the kind words. And that was an absolute blast, as always.
Thanks, my friend. Take care of yourself, Jim. Stay safe, everybody.
Good night now!